Hey, folks. I hope you're here because you like deep, thoughtful, political, and progressive analysis. Well, if you do, you're also going to love the print or online version of Current Affairs magazine. Current Affairs combines intelligent commentary, biting political satire, and gorgeous artwork to produce one of the country's most elegant and informative magazines, and it is all ad-free. Current Affairs is a great complement to the work we do here. In fact, some of the work we do here is just from stuff that we've read from Current Affairs, frankly. And of course, Nathan Robinson has been a frequent guest on this program. They provide you hard-hitting, totally independent, entertaining, insightful coverage of the world of politics, of, I mean, I'm looking at the Current Affairs right now, stories about, you know, how machines are never going to be sentient like animals, or what Israel's doing with the flotilla, a story on what's happening with the Riyadh Comedy Festival, on and on and on. Great stuff. And now use the code Majority Report, one word, you'll get 30% off for a year on any subscription of your choice. Go to currentaffairs.org/subscribe. Enter the code Majority Report at checkout. The offer expires October 31st. Now time for this show.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Tuesday, September 30th, 2025. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Federico Finkelstein, an Argentine historian and chair of the history department at the New School for Social Research, also director of the Janie Program in Latin American Studies, on our bailing out of Javier Milei. Also on the program today, government slated to completely shut down in almost exactly 12 hours from now, or at least it's going to be an explicit shutdown as opposed to the one we've been living through. Also, Hegseth's military gathering happens in D.C. amid reports that he is acting increasingly erratic. Netanyahu already planning to break the supposed peace deal he says he agrees with.
Oh, so like the last time in January, the exact same thing.
And probably the two times before that, I would say. YouTube pays $24 million in tribute to Donald Trump. Meanwhile, the Trump regime deports a plane load of Iranian asylum seekers back to Iran. Conservative eyebrows are raised as J.D. Vance and Donald Trump Jr. move to control TPUSA.
Hmm.
154,000 federal workers officially take their buyouts this week. And the Trump regime defends government, defunds the Government Inspector General Organization. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks so much for joining us. It is
Newsday Tuesday.
Yes. And there's obviously some big news. We've been seeing this coming for a while. Chuck Schumer has been desperate to float all sorts of different ideas on how to avoid a government shutdown. And I should say those ideas are really how to cave to a Trump and Republican demand on not just the budget, but also the way that they're governing. And for the most part, I think a lot of people in the House are really burned from the last time that Schumer caved on them at the last minute. And so they're...
Because they kept the caucus together. I mean, they all voted against in unison in the spring. So, yeah, there you go.
The heat is on them when they do this.
That's right. Here we are. I mean, like I say, you know, Chuck Schumer, it's hard to imagine a Senate leader less up to the moment than Chuck Schumer. The last Senate leader we had was Harry Reid. Harry Reid would come off as rather genteel, like an infirm old man. And he was hiding a knife under his coat pocket. I did not agree with a lot of his. I shouldn't say that. There were some positions he had that I did not agree with. He was personally so-called pro-life, but never pushed that in his position as a senator. He was a staunch defender of Social Security and Medicare, wanted to increase those. And he was a very aggressive fighter. He was undercut. There was a story, I think it's in actually one of Ryan Grimm's books, about how he was undercut during the Obama years by Joe Biden when he was trying to go hard at the Republicans. Chuck Schumer, on the other hand, both appears soft on the outside and is even softer on the inside when it comes to aggressively confronting this moment. And he can barely do it. Here is a prime example. He walks out of the White House today, and this is what he says in his press conference. I should say this was yesterday. All right, play this. They come out of the White House. Of course, he's projecting nothing but strength as he approaches. He's not sure where he is.
He lost okay. Hakeem there.
We need some sexy music here, right?
Yeah.
He's
okay.
Snack.
Well, we met with the president for the first time since all of these issues started.
Pause it for a second. Now, understand, this moment here is one of the few that it's guaranteed he's going to get TV time. It's not always, a lot of people, a lot of us assume, like, where are these people? How come there's no, you know, why aren't they out there doing politics? It's because the media doesn't necessarily cover them and doesn't get that much play. When you walk out of the White House 24 hours before a government shutdown, you know you're going to get it. So understand, to the extent that any of the American public sees anything, they're going to see this. And he comes out, and the first thing he says is, we haven't, I mean, forget the fact that he's lost. Okay. We are weak, he says, and we haven't been able to get in to see the president. The president allowed us to come and talk to him. That's the subtext of what he's saying here. But go ahead. Because listen, the American public doesn't care that you're whining, that you're getting bullied by a bully. That does not give them confidence that you know what you're doing.
Yep. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, we met with the president for the first time since all of these issues started, even though we have requested repeated meetings with Leader Thune, Speaker Johnson, and the president. We have very large differences on health care and on their ability to undo whatever budget we agree to through rescissions and through impoundment. closet. Well as popular.
Okay, go ask your mom or your friend if they know what impoundment and rescissions mean. You do because you hear us talk about it all the time. But if you went out and had a beer with one of your friends and said, this is like the impoundment law from 74 and rescissions, people would look at you like they look at me.
How about
you'd have no friends?
Right. But you could say we have deep disagreements. The White House is trying right now to undercut the core power of Congress right now, the ability to craft a budget. He is refusing to move on that very point. Trump has been good at this part, which is that maybe you say something in private in the midst of your negotiations, but use the bully pulpit to aggressively advocate for your stance.
Of course. You come out and you say, one of the problems we've had making a deal is that Donald Trump doesn't follow the rules and he's breaking things for the American people and we want him to stop. Right? Like this should be about, the Democrats are saying, like, he's doing bad things to Americans. We want him to stop. And that's why we're making demands. Go ahead.
On health care and on their ability to undo whatever budget we agree to through rescissions and through impoundment, as well as pocket rescissions. And I think for the first time, the president heard our objections and heard why we needed a bipartisan bill.
Stop it. Okay. So the president was very reasonable. He listened to us, and I really think I'm getting through to him. That's what's going on here. Instead of like saying something like, I don't know if the president understands what he's doing to the American public, but it's quite clear that he's doing damage.
How about that? How about point out that he's dementia Don and he's tweeting out AI videos or something like that?
Well, this is what Donald Trump posted 2 hours after they walk out of there. He heard them? I guess he did.
Maybe
this is
he
what
respects
he, this
them.
Is
Maybe
what
he thought
thinks.
They made progress.
This is what he put out.
Yep.
Look, guys, there's no way to sugarcoat it. Nobody likes Democrats anymore. We have no voters left because of all of our woke trans bullshit. Not even black people want to vote for us anymore. Even Latinos hate us. So we need new voters. And if we give all these illegal aliens free health care, we might be able to get them on our side so they can vote for us. They can't even speak English, so they won't realize we're just a bunch of woke pieces of shit, you know, at least for a while until they learn English and they realize they hate us too.
Okay, so aside from the blatant racism, aside from all the lies, aside from the fact that it's he's basically saying, you're my bitches. Look, this is how much I have respect for you. I appreciate you saying that I listened and that I was polite and that I treated you well. And here, you are my bitches. That is what he's saying. I mock you. I laugh in your face. I mean, this is what happens when you show this level of weakness. This is what happens when you assume that the fight is not something that you need to take to the American public, but it's something you need to show Joe Scarborough that you're being responsible. You need to show Ezra Klein that you're taking this seriously.
You need to show your donors, because the problem here is that Schumer's and Jeffries, of course, are beholden to donors, and the donors are panicked about the government shutdown. When the government shuts down, the stock market collapses, and that is primarily what they're concerned about. It's what he was concerned about in the spring, and it's what he's concerned about here, and of course, the Beltway opinions.
This is just bad politics. He's doing bad politics. And then, you know, Hakeem Jeffries was marginally better because he actually talked about what the issues were. Schumer's just here, like, desperate to, play the original one back to the press conference. Yeah, good. Just play it a little more.
Has not one iota of Democratic input. That is never how we've done this before. When I was leader, we negotiated
procedure,
four times.
Procedure.
With
procedure,
Republicans, and we never
procedure,
had a shutdown.
Procedure.
And so
procedure,
it's up to the Republicans whether they want to shut down or not. We've made to the president some proposals. Our Republican leaders will have to talk to them about them, but ultimately he's the decision maker. And if
he has
he
all
will
the power,
accept some of the things we asked, which we think the American people are for, on health care and on rescissions, he can avoid a shutdown.
See, this but is all like it's all like third party stuff. We think the American public is for this. We asked for some things on healthcare. How about just being explicit with the American public? If Donald Trump is not willing to make any changes on behalf of the American public, your health insurance rates are going to go sky high. Donald Trump is not willing to guarantee that the money we appropriate to keeping your kids safe when they eat food, to protecting workers in their place of work, to protecting consumers, and all of this stuff about tariffs, making all the inflation. We've asked him, you know, we'll work with you, but you need to help. These tariffs are killing the American public. And let's be clear, there's nothing about this government budget that has to do with tariffs. But there's also nothing about this budget that has to do with immigrants or so-called illegals getting health care, or Hakeem Jeffries wearing a sombrero and Mexican music and Chuck Schumer saying this. Chuck Schumer does not understand where he is or what time is it or what year it is or what's going on. He has been oblivious to the reality that we are all existing in. And it is fascinating to watch this. He is literally in some type of like parallel universe,
right,
talking to people who don't exist, who are not paying attention. It is just
But how about saying this? How about if you're not going to fund Americans' health care, if you're not going to promise that you're going to claw back money, which is Congress's authority to create a budget for the American public, we are not going to fund, and we shouldn't be funding, although he undercuts his argument by having voted for the budget previously, the ICE agents that are terrorizing your communities. They're still afraid to talk about the major domestic issue that people are experiencing all across the country of thugs going in and beating people up and breaking communities apart. Do they even have a demand on that front?
And the idea that this has nothing to do with the budget, tell me anything that that is coming from the vice president, the president, and every other member of this administration has anything to do with the budget. I mean, they understand when you have the microphone, you deliver a political message. The Democrats cannot do that because Chuck Schumer has studiously avoided having any political message. That is their stated agenda.
Lay in the grass, fall asleep in the grass until the midterms, because that's all that matters, right? And whatever damage he does in the meantime is, I guess, just gravy for their hopeful electoral chances, where they can squeak out a victory with, you know, some AIPAC-funded candidate. Can we just play that Jeffries response really quickly while we're
here? Yes, and so they walk out, and this AI video is put out, and how does Jeffries respond? Does he talk about the virulent racism, the demonizing of immigrants, what is being done to the American public?
And Mr. President, the next time you have something to say about me, don't cop out through a racist and fake AI video. When I'm back in the Oval Office, say it to my face. Say it to my face.
I'm glad that Hakeem Jeffries protected his own sort of like manhood here. But notice what's going on in the rest of the country. And I'm also glad that Hakeem Jeffries didn't say, well, God will sort it out. Wasn't that his thing?
God's
presidents
on the throne.
Come and go, but God's always here.
I would have put the over-under of me and eyes in a 30-second clip there at 4.5, and he went under at 4. So it is liberals. Part of why liberals are incapable of meeting this moment is because they don't have a politics versus leftists that are collectivists. And I am so sick of the centering of one's own celebrity. And frankly, Kamala Harris has been engaging in this. It's been since the Obama years that we've been doing this kind of crap. The like celebrity Democrat is not a liberal Democrat is not meeting the moment here where you place the focus on yourself. the way that Zoran Mamdani brings it consistently back to what he wants to do for New Yorkers and what the collective and people in the community are facing is exactly what the message should be. But you have this class of elite Democrats that go into rooms and people are impressed when they'll speak about themselves and that them as a figurehead, and they'll make money that way and how they're going to represent those donors' interests and that kind of thing. But it is rings so hollow. No one cares what about Hakeem Jeffries and himself experiencing a racist meme. The implication of the racist meme is what we should be talking about, and the fascist administration. Why are you making it about yourself in that moment? It is astounding.
Yeah, honestly, the most confident thing to say at that point is, I don't care what the president says about me. There are Americans suffering. And he's out there sitting in the White House, making AI videos, trying to mock me because I'm supposedly Mexican. The opportunity available to demonize Donald Trump in that moment, rather than just say, hey, tough guy, I'm here. You know what? If you're so tough, how about you don't even say anything to us and you go back to the White House and knock on the door and say, come say this to my face. Like, if you're really tough, like people see through this.
Yeah.
And you use the opportunity to show the American public that you are protecting them, not defending yourself.
And just before we go, just quickly, number one, that Adam Carlson, good follow on Twitter for some polling stuff. Just this is the aggregate of who would get blamed for a government shutdown. In each of the six publicly released national polls asking voters, Republicans get more of the blame. The average is 15 points. Now, you will hear in the pundit class that the opposition party is the one that gets blamed or harmed in the midterms coming up. If they help shut down the government. That is a lie that they are deploying because it's completely counterfactual. The last government shutdown that was the longest in history, Biden won after that. That was at the end of 2018 going into 2019. Biden won in the fall. The short one previously, there was a blue wave in the midterms. The one under Obama in 2013, the Republicans took back the Senate. And this is not saying it's a causal relationship, but the fact that the idea that it hurts Democrats' chances is a fiction, and they're using it as a fig leaf to cover up the fact that they don't want to do anything because their donors are afraid of the stock market.
All right. In a moment, we're going to be talking to Federico Finkelstein. He is an Argentine historian, chair of the history department at the New School for Social Research, and director of the Janie Program in Latin American Studies on the bailout that we're going to be doing of Javier Milei and why. But first, a word from our sponsors. I don't know if people have noticed, but I'm getting a little older. And as I get older, I'm always thinking I should go to the doctor more. Deal with all sorts of things. Like when I get, a malady, I go. However, it can be very difficult to find a doctor. But if you want to keep yourself healthy, the best way to do that, find a doctor. And if you can't find a doctor, and it's sometimes very hard to do, let me recommend ZocDoc. They make it easy to find the right fit and book an appointment fast and directly on their website. ZocDoc is a free app and website where you can search and compare high-quality in-network doctors and click to instantly book an appointment. ZocDoc lets you book in-network appointments with more than 100,000 doctors across every specialty. You can filter for doctors who are near you, take your insurance, and are a good fit for you. You can find the type of care you're looking for. Doesn't matter whether it's good side bedside manner or to fast wait times. Doctors with good listening skills. You can see all of the rankings and reviews. You can see their actual appointment openings, so you don't have to go back and forth. You choose a time slot that works for you. You click and you instantly book the visit. Appointments made through ZocDoc also happen fast, typically within 24 to 72 hours of booking. You can even get same-day appointments. I have used ZocDoc on multiple occasions, particularly when I'm traveling, because I've had a doctor in New York for like pre-internet days.
I found my dentist through ZocDoc here.
That's the thing, is it's super easy to use. You find high-quality doctors of all sorts. I know, Matt, you've used it too, haven't you?
Yeah, I found get my checkups through there and dermatology.
It really is, again, an obvious thing that should exist. And
it's
it does.
So much easier.
I want to thank ZocDoc for sponsoring today's episode. You can stop putting off those doctor's appointments and go to ZocDoc.com/majority to find and instantly book a top-rated doctor today. That's ZocDoc, ZocDoc.com/majority, ZocDoc.com/majority. I'll put the info in the podcast and YouTube descriptions. Also, today apparently is National and International Coffee Day. Is that right? Coffee, of course, has been in the news quite a bit. Everybody's talking about it. Some prices going up some places. Today we've got some good news. It was National Coffee Day. Oh, I guess this was yesterday.
It's actually tomorrow.
Is it tomorrow?
October 1st.
Oh, all right. Well, so then it's National Coffee Day tomorrow. And you can save 20% on Sunset Lake Farmers Roast Sebade Coffee with our code LEFTISBEST. This is my weekend brew, ladies and gentlemen. Yeah. It's not just any coffee. It is shade grown. It is sustainably sourced and Rainforest Alliance certified, so you can feel good about every cup. SunsetLakeSabade.com. Small batch roasts it with a local roaster up in Vermont. They infuse the whole beans with their full spectrum Sabade. So it's balanced and not jittery. And honestly, it is the perfect way to start the day or get a smooth boost in the afternoon. Like I say, this is my weekend brew. When I don't want to get too hyped, but I need my coffee.
Yeah.
And of course, Sunset Lake Sebade, all of their Sebade is they don't use any pesticides. They do integrated pest management and regenerative farming. Just a great Sebade supplier, and their coffee is really a treat. Head over to sunsetlakesabade.com. Use our code LEFTISBEST to save 20% on Farmers Roast Coffee and all their Vermont-grown hemp products. See their site for terms and conditions. Okay, quick break. When we come back, Federico Finkelstein will be here, Argentine historian, chair of the History Department at the New School for Social Research. We are back. Sam Seder, Emma Vigeland on the Majority Report. I want to welcome Federico Finkelstein. He's an Argentine historian, chair of the History Department at the New School for Social Research, and director of the Janney Program in Latin American Studies. And professor, we were saying just before we came on that I think the last time we spoke was about 5 years ago. It was about one of your books. You've written, I feel like, a half a dozen books on fascism. We said, like, it's still in vogue, apparently, these days, maybe perhaps even more relevant. But let's turn specifically to the relationship between the United States and Argentina. And tell us, just if you can go backwards a little bit, and tell us what Javier Milei has been doing since coming to power, aside from giving Elon Musk a ceremonial chainsaw for Musk to tear up our government.
Yes. Well, I mean, all these things are connected because Milei is one of the last latest representatives of the wannabe fascist trend that Trump represents globally. And Milei actually has been an admirer, if not an imitator of Trump on so many levels. I have often called him a mini Trump in the sense that he wants to, you know, to behave like his master in a way. And yet he cannot for a variety of reasons, including the fact that Argentina is not as powerful as the U.S. is.
And let's talk about what his economic plans that he put. I mean, he's a like straight out of Mont Pelerin type of libertarian ideologue.
Yes, I mean, he claims to be a libertarian, and yet in terms of the economic front, his policies seem to be a kind of very standard austerity measure kind of government. I mean, he has been, the freedom part of libertarianism, whatever that is, has been absent from Milei's economics, you know, in terms of a lot of controls for currency control and many other things. That, of course, together with austerity measures, as we have seen here in the U.S.
And so what can you tell us about this bailout? Like, he has already received, I mean, I feel like as late as June in this country, I was seeing people sort of trumpet his economic policies as being sort of like the triumph of free market, neoliberal economic policies. And within weeks after that, he was getting a bailout of sorts from, I believe it was the IMF and the U.S. And now we're primed to provide $20 billion in swaps, which is essentially just like a backstop.
Yes, it is very strange when one think about it. I mean, from the position of the U.S., a government that has been like that had made a point of not helping the war, like, I mean, cutting USA and so on. Why helping this kind of mini Trump? So that's the first part of the answer. The first part of the answer is that this ideologically, these individuals are pretty much connected. Now, on the other hand, you know, Trump and his policies are very U.S.-centered, and even if they are allies, I mean, generally, like, one should not presuppose that the U.S. will support a given ally, in a country like Argentina. And yet, this is what we are seeing. The context of that is that although these policies have been celebrated, poverty had increased, incredible levels of poverty and income inequality. And all that coupled with the kind of typical Trumpist policies of hatred. I mean, homophobia, misogynist, like attacking the universities and so on. Unlike the U.S., I mean, in Argentina, when people demonstrate in the street, I mean, the kind of the government receives the message. So they are not waiting for elections. And twice in the last year, Milei, for example, said an awful homophobic comment and hundreds of thousands of Argentines protesting in the streets. He kind of stopped on that one. Like more recently, he started a la Trump attacking universities and hundreds of thousands of people in all Argentine cities, like kind of gave the message that this was not okay. And on top of that, 1 month ago, there were provincial elections in the most important state, the California of Argentina, if you will. I will even say California plus Texas of Argentina. And he lost, like as Trump will say, bigly. And that meant that that basically he's approaching the, you know, the midterm elections, which are very soon, in very dire straits. And in that context, is that Trump somehow, imposing himself in the campaign, trying to show that the U.S. support this model. Now, my own guess is that beyond ideological, connections and affinities, the very fact that Milei probably is, Milei has made Argentina into one of the most, yes, sir, allies of the U.S. I mean, both in every sense that the U.S. is promoting, with Trump. And that also, is important for Trump to have a yes, sir, like in one big country in the world, which is Argentina.
What about U.S.-based bondholders who have interests in Argentina, for whom these type of bailouts actually, like, it's a backdoor bailout of U.S.-based individuals. There's been some reporting that there's a U.S. billionaire that has important holdings there, and that when we are basically backstopping these Argentinian bonds, we're doing a bailout maybe for some of Trump's donors or friends or whatnot.
Yes, I will not discount that possibility. And obviously, we saw a picture that is to say, Mr. Besant reading a message from a member of his own government telling him that this is not good for U.S. farmers. So my point is, like, this will be, if that is the case, a typical example of Trump choosing, financial interests over the interests of, in this case, his own voters, or many of his own voters.
How does cryptocurrency fit into this, given Javier Milei's obsession with crypto, personal investments in it? I mean, I would not be shocked if there are some shared business interests that we're not even fully abreast of in that particular area.
I would not be shocked. I mean, I share with you the lack of surprise or potential surprise, because, I mean, what happened is, I mean, and this is a key reason why Milei lost. I would say that lost this, this provincial elections and maybe the next elections. Trump kind of confused this electoral cycle, because when he met with Milei in the UN, he kind of said that he supported Milei's presidential bid, which is going to happen if it happens a few years from now. But the point is that basically there was a big, I would say, I don't know if to say corruption scandal, but big suspicions of corruption when Milei, when he was the president, promoted in a tweet, it was called then a tweet, a kind of, crypto pyramid,
Is that the Libra one?
Yes. Yeah. So, and also there are like signs. I mean, there were internal communications. I mean, there was I think a $500,000 dollar transfer after some communication with people close to Milei. I mean, and so on and so forth. And in addition to that, his sister, who is basically he called his sister the boss, and this is the person basically running many aspects of Milei's government, more than a kind of a cabinet chief or something like that. The sister somehow was also, people very close to Milei talk in an audio about how she was receiving 2% of different contributions and so on. So, I mean, the point is that this is the anti-politics message that Milei promoted, and in a way was a big element in him coming to power. And many people, even voters, people that voted for him were really disappointed that this was just another example of government corruption, as it has been the case across the aisle in Argentina. So, I mean, this kind of anti-politics message, met with reality, and the realities of a typical politician who is very extreme, who represents Trumpism in Argentina, and no more than that.
I just also want to say that his sister and his relationship is extremely weird, and he had to come out many times to say that they were not in a romantic relationship, which feels like, if you have to say it, I mean, there's some weirdness going on there. But, like, I mean, the crypto and the state merging, I think, is something that we need to be on the lookout here in the United States. I mean, it's already happening, but like how Malay paired that with his austerity agenda is, I think, important to understand because, you know, when Elon Musk was running Doge, he went out at CPAC with Malay and Malay handed him the chainsaw, metaphorically handing over this agenda to the Trump administration and to Elon Musk. And so, like, I'm wondering if you could give more detail on that, the crypto piece of that, and fitting in with the deregulation and the destruction of the state capacity in Argentina.
Well, as you know, cryptocurrencies are great for avoiding, avoiding any type of control. And historically also they have been linked to crime and corruption. So this is something that, you know, from Argentine eyes looks also very suspicious in the U.S., I think. You know, the fact that Milei apparently, or people have said that that there was like perhaps a payment for the tweet, but we are talking about pennies vis-a-vis the increase in billions of the presidential fortune in the U.S. So the point is like this is interesting because we are looking not only at a kind of political style, which in my view is wannabe fascist, and it wants to leave behind, you know, key democratic controls and procedures on one hand, and a kind of global corruption on the other, which might be supported or not by cryptocurrency. Again, like it's very hard to know, and I guess either, justice investigators in a perfect world or historians of the future will deal with this. At this point, we don't know much, but I think it's, you know, it's important to think about these links.
I want to just broaden out just a little bit because you refer to Malay as a wannabe fascist. What's the part that makes him wannabe as opposed to fascist? And what can we learn from that in this country to help Trump be more wannabe in that sense?
Yes, I think that's the key point because, you know, being a wannabe fascist doesn't mean arriving at the fascist point, often because societies react, either by voting, by protesting, and also by asking for their own institutions to do and to play their role. I mean, like today, we are seeing like Trump's request for the military to participate in internal politics, including by mere acts of repression. And the question is like, what happens in a democracy when people, including the military, do not follow the constitution and they follow the wannabe fascist? I mean, and fascism happens. Now, many times it doesn't happen because of, things like such as like the ones we are doing right now, which is asking questions about power and being critical regarding what may be going on. Now, in Brazil, which is our neighbor, I mean, sorry, you asked me about Argentina. I would like to start with Brazil. In Brazil, which is our neighbor in Argentina, and they had a similar kind of mini Trump, which was, former President Bolsonaro. He also imitated Trump. 1 year later, he lost the elections and he attempted a coup d'etat. And the difference between Brazil and the U.S. Is that, you know, Bolsonaro has been put on trial and he now has been, he's a criminal and he has been convicted of those crimes of attempting to a coup d'etat. Now, the question is about Argentina and the U.S. In Argentina, they have seen Brazil. In the U.S., they don't seem to care, or even worse, Trump is like punishing Brazil for the separation of powers in their own democracy. And all these things are interconnected. And I think the question goes, in Argentina, it relates to a warning from Brazil, but also a kind of message from the U.S. that everything goes. That everything goes, that, you know, there can be incredible amounts of enrichment by those in power, incredible amounts of unconstitutional acts every single day, and nothing happens. So this is very much in the open. And here the U.S. has an incredible, role to play in either sending a democratic message or an anti-democratic one.
I mean, I know it goes that way, right? What does history show us about the relationship between a fascist or would-be fascist leader and the It's like the disposition, but the material context of the population at large. So, you know, following World War One, Germany was in a pretty dark place, particularly following the Treaty of Versailles, and they were put in a position where they were, there was like sort of broad national humiliation and material deprivation. I get, like, you know, there's two parts of that relationship, right? There's the fascist and the fascie, I guess. What in a more modern context where you have, I think, like, we definitely have a bunch of different strains of complaints by the American public that range from material deprivation to large segments feeling like they've lost social, they've had, like, you know, social deprivation loss, like no longer having a certain privilege. We're having to compete across a broader set of people, be they women, be they black or brown. What do we know about where the public sits in our context in the U.S. and what works from a fascist perspective or wannabe fascist perspective?
Yes, well, fascists, I mean, they sell hatred, I mean, instead of goods or material improvements. This is the reason why all, you know, many, you know, almost a century, more than a century ago, like German social democrats called, you know, the proposal of fascism, the socialism of the imbeciles, because basically they don't give you anything but hatred, a sense of superiority and so on. And that goes so far. At some point, economic crisis and, you know, and poverty kicks, and that is the reason why many people lament, you know, they have supported this kind of anti-democratic choices. Sometimes that takes time. And you know, and this, and society suffers. So I cannot be, you know, extremely optimistic here. I mean, of course, we know that once, I mean, this is, I mean, at least from my position, it's clear that, that, you know, that people like Trump or Milei are not improving the, you know, the living conditions of the majorities. So at some point that will kick in. But again, it often takes a lot of time. And sometimes we don't have that much time. I mean, you know, the governor of California said, like, recently, by 28, we might not have an election. And I'm afraid to say is that the wannabe fascism wants to become fascist, and maybe that will be the case. But it's hard to know, and it depends on all of us. I mean, to really make it clear that we don't agree with this.
Well, to what extent can does social science have a number as to the demand for hate? In other words, like, I mean, if they're selling hatred, right? I mean, like, everybody likes material improvement, but not everybody is really in the market for hatred to satisfy them, even in a short-term basis, right? And there's obviously close to half, if not half, based upon the 2024 election. But I would suspect that there's, you know, there's less than half. But the question is, like, how much less than half? And also, how much do you need to sustain it over the course of an extended period of time?
Well, in that, you know, Argentina might be an interesting case to answer the question, because we don't have, like, this kind of anti-democratic institutions such as the Electoral College. You know, we changed the constitution many years ago because, you know, our constitution was very similar to the one in the U.S., but we don't have that anymore. And there were two rounds in the presidential election. In the first round, 30% voted for Milei, I guess, like, among those, you know, I mean, homophobes and misogynistic people were, like, clearly among those. And then, like, to have the majority, another right-wing kind of center-right voted for him in the second round. Now, those are easy to peel off in a situation like that in Argentina. And in Argentina, we have something that maybe the U.S. didn't have, which is a collection of many dictatorships, and people, I mean, and some people remember them. I was born you know, right before one of them, and people of my generation remember them. Now, the question is, you know, people that are younger and they have always lived in democracy, and sometimes they don't realize what they have. And in that context, given another aspect that we need to address, and I'm talking about Argentina, I might be as well talking about the U.S., is that, you know, there was a failure in Argentine politics by politicians of the center, the right, and the left. I mean, they created conditions which were, well, which were terrible socially and economically, and that's when Milei, you know, appeared as a kind of, in a kind of perfect storm. Like Argentina, and this is different to the U.S., was the country with the highest inflation in the world. I mean, and on the left, on the center left, the economic minister was the candidate. So that was a kind of, you know, in a way, easy, you know, position for Milei to represent. That is to say that he was against that. He represented anti-politics. Now, Argentine voters and Argentines in general are very impatient with this, and already they sent a big message like last month. So the question is, in the U.S., it might be a little bit different, because I think at this point in Argentina, it's not that easy to tamper with voters as they are doing in the U.S. with gerrymandering and so on. So the question is, even if you have the votes, how many votes do you need to win an election if they are all the time dealing with this? And this is a question of, you know, I wrote an article for the New Republic before the election about the one-day dictatorship. And I'm curious. So every, you know, 10 days, I go back to the article to see how let's say, which is the percentage in which were Emanuel Guerrizoli and myself, that we wrote the article, how close we were. I mean, and I think at this point, probably 50, 60%. I mean, what it takes to have a dictatorship. Like, and we are seeing a lot of that here, a lot.
In the U.S.
In the U.S. And ironically, in Argentina, less so. That because we might not have in Argentina strong institutions, but in Argentina the popular, you know, the political culture is that people do not stand by this mix of corruption and lies at this point.
What is it that, I mean, because you said he went after gay people and then hundreds of thousands show up and he went after universities. And hundreds of thousands show up and he backs off that because of, you know, you have a limited amount of capital with, whether it's with the military or politically, and you don't want to expend that on areas if you can find a separate one. Is that just a history? I mean, like, you know, several hundred thousand showing up, I would imagine, is like, you know, the equivalent of 2 or 3 million in this country showing up about something like mobilizing, you know, relative to population size. Is that because there's and we don't get that really very often in any type of sustained way in this country. The Iraq War, maybe, during BLM, we had that, was probably the closest we got to it. What is that a function of, in your mind?
Well, I mean, the equivalent will be, it's very symbolic, right? Like it will be as having every now and then the Washington Mall and the main squares in every city full of people. I mean, that's the message, like that people mobilize in order to give a message to those, you know, to those in power. In the U.S., I mean, there is an ambient effect in which, I mean, things that you know, that are said and done every day should be provoking, you know, people in terms of reactions and protests.
Donald Trump has doubled his net worth, which means he's made billions in 9 months as president. Yes. That's a little suspect.
And even with the history of corruption that we have in Argentina, I don't think this will be acceptable. Voters, you know, express their concern for less than $1 million.
How much of it is a function of simply a sort of tradition or a history or mistrust of politicians and the political system that may exist in Argentina because there is a sort of like a a more of a history of having a political turmoil, but also how much of it is like a political leadership that doesn't respond to that. Like I would imagine there are the social structure and fabric of Argentine society, and I don't know this, but I would imagine is sewn together in a way with more traditions of labor power and solidarity in certain areas than perhaps in the United States, at least in the past 100 years or so. But what impact does like political leadership have to do in this respect as well?
Well, in Argentina, there is a tradition of being suspicious of politicians across the aisle. And then again, like our history of dictatorships, we know, I mean, many of us at least know what dictatorship is. We have lived it. And it involved these kind of connections that we are talking about, like, of course, higher level of repression, but also incredible amounts of corruption and poverty, because the result of that also is poverty. And whenever someone or something resembles the past, then many people are worried that you know, this is just another pattern that we have lived. And I think, you know, Milei was given a vote because it was a message. There was dissatisfaction with, you know, with the typical politicians, and people were willing to give a pass to someone who was self-described as crazy. I mean, in terms of what is interesting is that in terms of practice, Trump is way more, I would say, radical than Milei. In terms of, you know, speech, Milei is way more radical than Trump. I mean, he's even more vulgar. When compared to Milei, looks like a stable individual. I mean, which is to say a lot. I mean, Emma, when you were talking about the possibilities that, I mean, the rumors basically, and who, in a way, like, about Milei being involved with his sister, his response as president of Argentina was, I will quote, I don't F my sister. I mean, this is the level of Milei's engagement with the public. He has also, he's using all the time these kind of metaphors of violence and even rape towards others. But the sad part of it, I think, and this is related to what Sam was saying before, is that, I mean, about this, many people did not seem to care. I do. Many others do, but a lot of people did not seem to care about the hatred or in this country the racism, and a philosopher like a very famous radical philosopher Theodor Adorno said that when he was after the Holocaust and so on in the 1960s he was surprised about the resurrection of the German right, and he said that people like us, we care a lot about rights. But many people do not care about that, and the message they get is when economic conditions provoke more poverty, and that's when they realize, what's going on. And sadly, you know, many people will see that part, not the parts about rights. In my view, the two are together. They go together. They are part of an ideological project, which is, as I have called it, wannabe fascism.
Well, Federico Finkelstein, we will link to your books, one of which is Wannabe Fascist, at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break, head into the fun half to have more fun.
The heat is on them when they do this.
Yep. Feeling the pressure.
He's just trying to speak it into existence.
Just a reminder, it's your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member, join themajorityreport.com. When you do, you not only get the free show free of commercials, but you also get the fun half. And most importantly, the exclusive important thing is that you help this show survive and thrive. Become a member today, join themajorityreport.com. Also, check out the AM Quickie, amquickie.com, every day. Email blast in your mailbox. 3 days a week for free. Corey, Whitney do a great job. Whitney's tearing it up for the American Prospect right now as well. Check out their daily roundup of the news that is important to you.
It's really important for me in terms of preparing for the show. I always check it to see if I miss anything. And I've gotten some, family to subscribe, and they're loving it too, because they don't have to, check all these different papers. It's great.
Yep. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, hot chocolate. Use the coupon code majority, get 10% off. As always, give us a review on iTunes if you can go back in time and leave it there, or in the podcast app that you use, or
Apple Podcasts.
Well, people use different podcast
True.
Apps.
True. Yes. Right.
Say hi to George Bush for us.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly. Or if you're on Twitch, give us your subscription for the month. If you're a Prime member, then you already have paid for it. You can just direct it towards us. Et cetera, et cetera. Matt, Left Reckoning.
Left Reckoning tonight, talking with Gil Duran about Peter Thiel's Antichrist tour. Also, if you're not subscribed to the Left Reckoning on YouTube, I plug it every day. But anyway, you can
you
do
jerks.
It. But you
what's
know,
wrong with you?
Today's a great day to finally, after 5 years, hit subscribe on that.
Shaming them.
We are subscribing. It's a subscriber shamer.
We are 558 subscribers shy of 50,000. So I'd like to hit that and redeem yourself a little bit. So check out tonight.
Grow up.
7 o'clock Eastern time, patreon.com/leftreckoning. We're going to get into Ezra Klein's identity crisis, which I think we're going to be talking about on here too. But
oh my god.
Yeah. So that's what I was going to say when you were like the so-called fun half. I'm like, well, we'll make fun of Ezra Klein kind of getting clowned by Ta-Nehisi Coates, but listening to him is not fun. So
what, Harry Emden?
I'm done trying to like Ezra Klein, basically.
I feel sorry for him again.
A lot of people feel
liberated.
Oh,
I do not feel sorry for him. I'm sure he's fine.
Cyclical. Folks, we'll see you in the fun house.
You are in for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun house.
Oh, no. Oh, no. Are you ready?
Who sent us this?
Alpha males are back, 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 back. Boy is back, and the alpha males are back, back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back, 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 back. Boy is back, and the alpha males are back, 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 back.
Just wanna degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back, back. Back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back, back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar, what a fucking nightmare!
Yeah, or a couple of them, just put them in rotation.
DJ Danner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
See white people doing drugs that look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych, fuck them, fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bang. A hell of a lot of bang. A hell of a lot of bank, okay. I'm making stupid money. Hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank.
All lives matter.
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black African. And the alpha males are black, 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 black. And the Africans are back, 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 back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100. Can't knock the hustle. Come on, fuck them, fuck them.
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday.
My birthday.
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy.
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are black, black. Africans are back, back.
Come on. What? Come on. What? Come on. Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total pussy, 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 pussy.
We are back. Sam Cedar, Emma Viglin, Majority Report. I don't know if we're going to play it again, but that food delivery guy video from yesterday, people released the first part of that, and it's actually even better because he rides his bike up. He sees the ICE trying to think of like what to call them. Like federales is too almost dignified for them.
Yeah. That sounds like it's an air of respectability.
Thugs provides them with too much like intimidation factor because sometimes they are really inept. Pigs is just too much of a throwback,
but they're hogs.
It's on top though.
ICE hogs.
Did he call? I think this guy calls them pigs too. Or what does he say here at the beginning? He calls them something.
All right, well, let's just listen to a little bit. I want to avoid playing it, but I'll do it. Like,
He's wearing Jordans too. I love that.
But the guy just going. And first off, like, they would have caught him, and they would have arrested him. Yeah. Maybe they just would have beaten him up. But it turns out in America, you're allowed to say F Trump.
You were. Back when things were woke.
Until it was hate speech.
Yeah, see that? One guy says he dropped his phone, and they gets it. And then the other guy comes after him.
So they wait until he gets down to grab his phone, and that's when the guy takes his opportunity and to get embarrassed.
Oh.
Look,
he also falls off
down.
Of the and he's the one who has to go around that white pylon. Incidentally, we have those white pylons in New York City too, and they bend.
Look at it. I mean, this is bad stability here. He just comes off the curb, and that weight, he's not used to carrying that much weight and almost plants.
You know, they talk about in football, like the best pass rushers.
He can't turn. He can't turn there. He has to.
That is a wide turn.
Tiptoe around that white thing.
I was just saying, in football, they talk about having bend. That guy has negative bend if you're a pass rusher. He doesn't have the core athleticism to turn the corner.
And of course, the delivery guy escapes. I want to play this number 11. There's two things I want to play, which I think are really important because they're going to be sending these guys all over the country. We're going to start to see them increasingly, geared up in their brand new military uniforms. Marching through New York. They're going to be marching through Boston. They're going to be watching through New Orleans and Denver. I mean, they're going to be all over the place. And so there are things that I think are really instructive. There are two things that I think in terms of like, you know, what you can do, we're going to continue to play those videos. And there's plenty of them where you, you confront the ICE people, you either follow them down the street if they're just marching and not going after anybody, playing Star Wars Death March theme, I think is great because the idea is you want to humiliate these guys. You want to embarrass them to the extent that they can. There's a reason why they have masks, and it's not because they all think they're going to get doxxed and that they think that all the people they're going up against are going to do some. It is they are embarrassed. They are taking the money, and they're embarrassed. And the more that you play on their embarrassment, the better. And so, you know, confrontations, we've got videos of, some of which there's so much swearing. I'm not sure we can play it, but We, you know, where a guy shows up because his mother's being detained and he shows the ID and he's like, take the effing cuffs off my mother right now. You guys are, you know, P words and you guys are a-holes and et cetera, et cetera.
You sea suckers.
Well, he said there you're a sea sucker because that's what the ICE guy had said to him. And but also the most important thing is he said, your kids are going to be embarrassed by you. And to the extent that any of these guys are parents, your kids are going to be embarrassed by you. Your grandparent, your grandkids are going to want to change their last name so they're not associated with you. This is important because if they are projecting out their weakness, which is they are afraid of taking responsibility for what they're doing. And so that's very important. But in terms of like other broader strategic things, there are two other places. One, it's good to have governors who are out there encouraging people to do this. Play this Pritzker. Do we have the Pritzker one?
Yeah.
Pritzker went out there and made a point. And this doesn't seem like a big deal, I think, to a lot of people who listen to this show, because if you see ICE people out there, you're going to do that. You know, the people who watch this show are, you know, range from being very tactical in inhibiting ICE's operations. And those people are anonymous and they are very careful about operational security, et cetera, et cetera. But also following around ICE people in your neighborhood and just yelling to your neighbors, don't open your door if they don't have a warrant. Now, there's still, we have video of them busting into people's houses without a warrant, but that's illegal. And at least there's some, but videotaping them. And so when the governor gets out and says something like this, it gives license to people who are right on the cusp of, do I engage? Do I get involved? When the governor of a state does this, it's important.
Every governor
should be doing this.
Yep.
If you see ICE, videotape them, ostracize them. Don't interfere physically because then they'll arrest you. But let's listen to this.
We'll continue to fight this with everything that we have. So people of Illinois, we need your help. Get out your cell phones. Record and narrate what you see. Put it on social media. Peacefully ask for badge numbers and identification. Speak up for your neighbors. We need to let the world know that this is happening and that we won't stand for it. I was surprised and pleased to see that a federal agent in New York was put on leave after he was caught throwing a woman to the ground. Good. Good. That would never have happened, though, if it wasn't on camera. So keep documenting. It could make a world of difference for someone, perhaps for all of us.
Now, we should say that same guy got reinstated a day later. He got reinstated probably hours after Pritzker had said that. And maybe in part because Pritzker had said it.
Mm-hmm.
But the point is, he's encouraging people. He's giving people a license to do something that people aren't sure that they should be doing. Now, of course, most of you know this. But for your general person, you know, your general public member, they're probably wondering, can I videotape? And now they know they can. And now they're actually gotten encouragement for it. This is really important stuff. And then the other dynamic coming out of Illinois is this. There's a lot of problems, particularly with big city police departments, but also, you know, some small ones. But understand, they don't want to be big-footed by people with less training than them and who think that they run everything either. So there's a good opportunity here for conflict, and this must be encouraged. Here's an example. Now I say that without any sort of like knowledge of the Broadview police in Illinois, this guy or whatnot. It's largely irrelevant. He seems like a decent guy, but it doesn't matter. Here we go.
I was shocked I was shocked. I've never been spoken to by a fellow law enforcement officer in such a way.
Broadview Police Chief Thomas Mills says on top of requiring 75% of his department's manpower for crowd control outside of the ICE processing facility in the West Suburban City, he was personally verbally attacked by ICE agents during a protest.
I'm a leader of a department. I know that my office is looking at me for guidance and leadership, and I had to ensure that, you know, I had to stay calm and not engage in such unprofessional behavior.
Chief Mills says he was walking across a skirmish on September 12th, the day this video was shot. He was called multiple expletives by an ICE agent, calling him a coward, accusing him of neglecting his duties during protests that got physical. Mills also telling the I-team about an incident earlier this week where a pedestrian was hit by a truck near the ICE facility.
Allegedly, a ICE agent struck someone and continued on into their location. And during the course of that, while trying to gather information, there was pepper spray released while my officer's right there. They felt the effects of that pepper spray where it altered their vision. You know, they were coughing, and I was on the phone with them. And they had to leave the area so they can decontaminate themselves.
Now, Broadview's mayor has issued a blistering letter to ICE excoriating their actions, saying, quote, Broadview police officers are routinely being exposed to ICE agents' tear gas volleys, forcing them out of action until they recover. Broadview firefighters and ambulance personnel are being exposed. Nearby residents are being exposed. Beleaguered Broadview residents are begging for relief from your center's siege of our neighborhood.
Okay, so here's the thing. The ICE people are almost always going to be from outside your community. And regardless of what your feelings are about the cops in any context, this is you don't have to aggrandize them, but remind them you and that cop are from the same community. You know, play on sometimes their prejudice. Right.
I mean, they have to stay there. The ICE folks are going to ship up in a second.
And so, like, you know, if the ICE people are starting to fire off pepper pellets, wander towards the cops. And let them either follow that fire towards the cops. I mean, this is the thing. You want to engage the police, your local police, and you want them to be engaged on your side. And I mean that literally as a tactical thing, not even necessarily, you know, spiritually. You're from this community. We're all community members, you know, et cetera, et cetera. These are the outsiders. Remember, in almost 99.9% of the time, the ICE people, whatever you want to call them, pendejos, whatever, they are more outsiders than the immigrants they are coming to disappear.
Absolutely.
And so... And the cops on some level know that too. Not maybe every one of those cops, but certainly there's going to be a cop or two. And all it takes is one of those cops to get some of that tear gas in their eyes or get hit by a stray, untrained ICE guy's pepper pellet. And it's going to turn. And that's going to be increasingly important.
This is the reality of these ICE occupations that is, you know, gives the lie to all the Republicans like or Dave Rubin saying, we just come in there to help your city. They don't live in these communities that are hosting ICE. ICE rents and ICE takes up residence in lower income communities. And when they have to protect their facilities, they gas and put pepper all into the air. That lingers. None of the people saying, oh, why do you have a problem with ICE?
Put this up, this Portland thing.
What are the people that say, oh, why do you have a problem with ICE in your community? They don't live in the communities where ICE facilities are. Where
Brian, pop this up here.
These things don't, this gas lingers around so you can't walk your pets. Or it gets into your house and guess who's lower to the earth? Children are crawling around. Like this stuff hovers over the ground. That's what the reality of this occupation is people wheezing.
So very important. Use all the tools available to you in your community. And, you know, the cops, regardless of what you think of them, are a tool for you to use. Any type of conflict that can be created with ICE, anything to keep them as sort of like sequestered and perceived as outsiders is important.
And it helps that you have the governor and the mayor who are kind of standing in unison and saying this publicly. It both emboldens regular citizens and also the police to police their communities. Because part of the critique of police brutality is often that you'll have police departments that are filled with suburban cops that don't actually live in their communities. And this is on hyperdrive with ICE.
Yeah, just psychos from other communities.
Exactly. They behave as an occupying force in those instances. And ICE is now just explicitly doing that as a part of their modus operandi.
And understand, this is only going to get worse.
Yeah.
Only going to get worse. Hopefully someday it'll get better, but it is a long way off.
And I'm not trying to overstate, whatever. Pritzker has issues, I know, was on the board of AIPAC at one point. Hate that. But this is the blueprint for the rest of Democratic governors going forward. And when he eventually runs for president, I'm not going to be shocked when he contrasts the way that he responded to Gavin Newsom's response.
Go to the IMs for a moment. Jamie from the UK. Hi, Sam, Emma, Matt, and Brian. I'm a disabled progressive activist. I sent an IM yesterday about how I feel about doing impression of RFK's voice as disablest. I just wanted to respond as I don't think I explained it well. Specifically, impersonating someone's minority identity is punching down, like Gervais and Chappelle do. For example, when people do impressions of Chuck Schumer, they don't wear a bigger nose, as that would be racist. I agree. I know that he's a traitor to me and the rest of the disabled community, but this doesn't mean the aspect should be targeted. Right. Right. A racist trope should not be targeted. You don't have to mimic those aspects of someone to mock them. Well, okay. I get that. You're going a little bit further from the analogy is not the same because, I don't need to. I got this prop with the glasses to further the impression of Chuck Schumer. I've got to do Chuck Schumer's voice to do Chuck Schumer, to do impression of Chuck Schumer. And I want to make it clear, I don't have a huge stock in my impression abilities. If, for say, Kennedy was in a wheelchair and I made jokes about how he can't maneuver around tight spaces or whatever. And I was mocking him for being in a wheelchair. Then I would agree.
Right.
And I am not mocking Bobby Kennedy for his voice. I am impersonating his voice. So if tomorrow, because I know that he takes injections for his voice, I know this because he would do this before we would do the show. Sometimes his voice gets better. If tomorrow his voice was different, like mine, just raspy.
Ask not what you've been just started right, sounding like that.
I would change my impression and I would have no compunction about it. And it wouldn't be any more or less funny in my mind because the joke is not there. Like, I don't, this brings up actually a good opportunity for me just to mention. Who's the Caboose is playing at the Roxy. People can check it out. It's screening next Monday, 7 p.m., as part of Mary Bronstein is a filmmaker. Apparently, she liked the film. She's going to be there. I am afraid that I won't be, but you can go see that screening if you want to see the movie in a Roxy Theater in New York. But my point in bringing that up is it's a mock documentary. I was not making jokes about the format of documentary, but I was doing the format. That was the way the story was being told. I cannot do an impression of Bobby Kennedy and not do his voice. Because then no one would know who I'm talking about. I can't say I'm Bobby Kennedy right now, and we should not follow the science. It's just not going to be entertaining. So I just wanted to make that clear that I don't think, certainly not on my end, but I also don't think people are going like that, Bobby Kennedy. His voice is just so bad. The other stuff about the anti-vax stuff, I don't have a problem with that. I mean, nobody's getting that from my impression of him. So I understand what you're saying, but to ignore his voice would also be equally as weird.
How would you even do it?
I don't know.
Ask not what, I mean, I guess
it would be a JFK impression.
It's the seed oils. The seed oils are giving us autism.
I mean, hey, it's disorienting, but at least it's, you know, not problematic.
Onion breath. Please ask the guests where Trump got the authority to bail out Argentina. He just does it.
Yeah, what do you mean? Yeah, I'm president. What are you talking about?
God did that. I believe that.
God did that. I believe that too.
Truck nuts. Oh, that job, by the way, I work for disability under SSA and DHHS. I'm not sure I follow what that is reference to, but Wiggleland, are we thinking enough about battleships, by the way? As in Venezuela? Is that the question? I don't know.
Those are like cigarette boats.
No, that we're shooting, but I'm not convinced our battleships aren't moving off the coast of Venezuela right now. Mm. Militant apathy. He said it's in God's hands and he's proving it. Sad, but that was better than Chucky. Oh, he's talking about Hakeem Jeffries. Make the fun half fun again. Please go to HUDs.gov website and look at the message about shutdown plastered on the homepage.
Trump said the radical left is shutting down the government on the HUD page.
I mean, I get, like, I've seen how political they are with the traditionally like government accounts. I just don't know how much of an impact this has. I do think, like, we got those emails about Social Security. A few months ago. That is deeply problematic, but it's just like, who's checking the freaking HUD website?
Joe Banks, please talk about the new Amazon Hawk video. Eamon Hawk video, is that what you mean? The Sam appearance makes the whole thing. I have not been aware of that. New Eamon Hawk video. Oh, the legend of Ethan Klein is out now. Go watch it. Oh, well, I'll save that to watch. Somebody's going to get sued. Somebody's going to get sued. All right, let's go to, oh, there have been increasingly reports, it's in the Daily Beast, but it was also in the British Telegraph, I think it was. Was it the Telegraph or what was it in? That Pete Hegseth is acting very erratic.
No.
Like, he can't stand still.
That's weird.
He's pacing around. He's freaking out. He's, like, mildly paranoid. I can't imagine what would cause that in a person.
Well, usually when
Brian, you've been in green rooms of comedy clubs in comedy clubs at 1 a.m. Like, what have you noticed when people are like that? Or I should just say, in your own bathroom.
I've noticed nothing. I don't know what you're talking about.
This is. I mean, I wonder. I've never seen any behavior like it's erratic and people are like running around like that. I don't know.
Maybe it's the stress of the job.
It could be the stress of the job. But I never knew anybody who was actually the Secretary of War. So, but they seem to get really stressed out from also like doing comedy before and after. Or in college, even when they were pulling all-nighters. Anyways, here's Pete Hegseth. Addressing the nation's generals and admirals. And he also is doing it from the set of the movie Patton.
Today, at my direction, each service will ensure that every requirement for every combat MOS, for every designated combat arms position, returns to the highest male standard only.
Mm.
Because this job is life or death. Standards must be met. And not just met, at every level, we should seek to exceed the standard, to push the...
Male standard? Like male room or M-A-L-E? The standard of post office? Because I agree with that. Oh. Oh, no. It's just about people's sex.
They bust in all the fat generals and going to go have to work for ICE?
With physical fitness and appearance. If the Secretary of War can do regular hard PT, so can every member of our joint force. Frankly, it's tiring to look out at combat formations or really any formation and see fat troops. Likewise, it's completely unacceptable to see fat generals and admirals in the halls of the Pentagon and leading commands around the country and the world. It's a bad look. It is bad, and it's not who we are. So whether you're an airborne ranger or a chairborne ranger, a brand new private or a four-star general, you need to meet the height and weight standards and pass your PT test.
What's the
and
test?
As the chairman said, yes, there is no PT test.
It's like 30 Can you pause sit-ups, it? 40 push-ups, and you have to run 2 miles in like under 20 minutes.
That was the woke test. Now the test is RFK Jr. looking at you and deciding if you have any mitochondrial deficiencies. Trump is fat as shit, by the way, but I guess he's not.
He's a commander in chief.
Top of the armed forces.
It starts from the top.
I need my energy.
Yep.
It starts from the top. I want to see Donald Trump run 2 miles. Can you imagine
Donald Trump did that?
Running 25 yards?
He couldn't even, he took a broken escalator where he had to walk up a flight of stairs and said that was basically an assault on him and almost an attempted assassination, which given his health, it could have been.
He talks about that again in this speech at this, in front of this flag. He talks about the stairs again.
Let's put it up. God. Yeah, let's put it up here, right here. Yeah, let's play this clip, and then we'll get to him complaining about... go ahead.
Our history is filled with military heroes who took on all enemies, foreign and domestic. You know that phrase very well. That's what the oath says, foreign and domestic. Well, we also have domestic. Foreign and domestic. You
so
know that
what
phrase
is this?
Very well. That's what the oath says, foreign and domestic.
Did the what happened with Trump? Why isn't Trump nearly as energetic as Hegseth?
I don't think he partakes.
Foreign and domestic. Now here he is saying that he's basically saying, telling the military that he's about to use them domestically.
Wait, that's what we just watched.
That is the one we just watched. We'll play it again. I mean, don't get distracted by how sort of like lethargic Trump seems.
It's the worry. I'm the sleepy warrior.
I don't like Pete having these things. When
I am the
it's
sleeping
my
dragon.
Monthly treatment for Alzheimer's.
My nap went 2 hours.
Why the hell is this speech so late?
Our history is filled with military heroes who took on all enemies, foreign and domestic. You know that phrase very well. That's what the oath says, foreign and domestic. Well, we also have domestic. George Washington, Abraham Lincoln, Grover Cleveland, George Bush, and others all used the armed forces to keep domestic order and peace. Many of our leaders used the military to keep peace. Now they like to say, oh, you're not allowed to use the military.
The juxtaposition.
He's talking in his sleep.
Honestly, the juxtaposition between him basically justifying, we're going to throw out posse comitatus.
Oh, I forgot I had a class at this time.
Storm every shit is this
country. Wait, you said the final test is today. I forgot all about it.
Okay. Put the military. You know, it's so bizarre. Someday they're going to do a movie about this and call it The Sleepy Dictator.
Imagine if Patton was on Ambien when he did this. Yeah.
Oh, my God.
And then they said the phone.
Honestly, it's exhausting to watch him talk so sleepily. But as he threatens, essentially, to put military into the...
Sometimes the foreign becomes domestic.
Yeah, it is.
You know that term?
Here he is complaining about the stairs. Right after Pete Hegseth has said, "All you fat generals, you're going to have to get in shape." And now the President of the United States.
They looked at him falling downstairs every day. Every day the guy's falling downstairs. He said, "It's not our president. We can't have it." I'm very careful. You know, when I walk downstairs, or like I'm on stairs, like these stairs, I walk very slowly. Nobody has to set a record. Just try not to fall, because it doesn't work out well. A few of our presidents have fallen, and it became a part of their legacy. We don't want that. You walk nice and easy. You don't have to set any record. Be cool. Be cool when you walk down, but don't. Don't bop down the stairs. So one thing with Obama, I had zero respect for him as a president, but he would bop down those stairs. I've never said, da-da-da-da-da, bop, bop, bop. He'd go down the stairs, wouldn't hold on. I said, it's great. I don't want to do it. I guess I could do it. But eventually, bad things are going to happen, and it only takes once. But he did a lousy job as president.
Imagine being a general and being like, I effing flew from the Philippines for this guy to be talking about bopping down the stairs.
Obama bops. I could probably play basketball too. I just don't want
like
to.
The just amazing juxtaposition in the form and function. As he's trying to explain how Biden was unfit to be president, and this guy's just going off about, I gotta be very careful when I go downstairs and I'm like,
in front of the flag. So good.
It's just, oh my God.
He Hegseth spent like $30,000 to get up for this speech.
It's such a great sort of exhibit of a sick heart because he has everything. He just wins. He has so much victories. And he's jealous of how Obama bops down the stairs on Air Force One.
Just go down.
He has fucking everything.
Show off.
Everything. Constantly needing praise, this vessel that can never, ever be filled.
I'm super, super smart about the way I go downstairs, but no one ever gives me credit about it.
Obama's like Jesse Owens going down the stairs.
Also, our troops, who gives a crap what shape they're in? We're just pressing, like, the green button on the drone strike these days, right?
Yeah. Needed a six-pack to sit in my chair.
Use computers, but I don't know why they need to be yoked while doing it.
Yeah, I don't know why us chair-born Rangers had to be yoked.
Drone pilot drinking Mountain Dew all day.
Everybody's... As long as you go down the stairs, it's okay.
Oh, that was so crazy.
It's just unbelievable.
I mean,
you know how hard
that was a full minute.
Except to get his medicine ever since we've been blowing up the Caribbean.
Exactly.
You know, that shit's precious.
Exactly. Luckily, it was just fish.
Exactly. Right, that's why they've been bombing basically just fishermen in the Venezuela, because Pete Hegseth still wants his conduit.
His vitamin B.
Unbelievable. I mean, is there going to be a private meeting with these guys? I hope so, because the leaks from that are going to be just amazing.
Oh. It's just Pete Hegseth doing pull-ups in front of them.
Trump taking a nap.
Damn.
Let's see if I can call in here.
Oh, man. I feel weak.
Everybody go to sleep.
Bop down those stairs.
I could. I walk. I could bop. I could bop like anybody. I could bop if I wanted to. I just know it's not smart.
You know he was talking about Gerald Ford, too, and he's like,
100%.
Yeah, some presidents fall. Yeah. Because...
I used to watch Saturday Night Live all the time. Gerald Ford, I mean, Chevy Chase, whichever one that was. President Chevy Chase. Chevy Chase, that was fun.
Trump also has stumbled on Air Force One.
Yes.
Since, I don't know.
And that haunts him to this day,
from
apparently.
The Daily Mail here.
I may have to restart my computer for this. Shoot.
I think that's something we have to do every time now. But here's Trump tweet.
He's bopping too high.
Yeah.
Ooh, Biden's not the only one.
I love democracy.
We should just decide the next presidential election on an obstacle course.
Who has the fewest slip and falls?
American Ninja Warrior. More like American President. Who can get to the other side?
Most extreme elimination challenge with these guys would be so funny.
Yeah.
Shoot, I'm going to have to restart my computer. I'm going to lose all of my IAMs, though. Mm. This is a problem.
It just seems like a desecration, but you go ahead.
Well done. All right. Well, folks, I'll read a couple IAMs and then we're going to try and take some calls. Maddie Moron, sounds to me like you guys don't appreciate how effing granular Senator Schumer is playing this. Mm. Brennan, Los Angeles, Chuck Schumer's action only makes sense when you realize he's speaking specifically to wealthy donors. Ryan from Rochester. I figured out how to describe Ezra and liberalism in general. What he's saying is a reflection of Orthodox capitalist radical neutrality, where you set aside all ethics and morality in the name of taking more power, a.k.a. making more money. Don't put a sign in the window of your business that says no races, but also don't put a sign that says trans welcome. Don't take any moral positions in order to be easily commodified for selling the public your bullshit. It's hilarious that Ta-Nehisi gives gives to a wide perspective for Ezra while you guys are too effing granular. He wants people to have blinders on and just look what he wants. Exactly. All right, two more of these, and then I'm going to... Sam, the Twitch Collective is feeling slighted by the lack of poggers earlier, and we now demand not only a poggers, but a oo-a. A what? Oo-a? Do you know what that is?
Oo-woo.
Oo-woo?
I'm not sure what it is, but I've seen it before.
To make up for it. Poggers and oo-woo. I don't know. Brian's looking like somebody just...
What?
Sea sucker.
Maybe.
Since when did MR censor the broadcast?
I just thought sea sucker sounded funny.
Josh from Houston. Houston, want to ask you to promote the GoFundMe for the Texas A&M professor Melissa McCool, who was fired for her lit course that had LGBTQ material. I have to remember, it's not just TV comedians that are being attacked. Folks, check that out. All right, I'm going to restart the computer. In the meantime, let's... all those IMs. Can't stand
I have some still.
Okay. All right, well, let's play this. Ta-Nehisi Coates and Ezra Klein were on the Ezra Klein Show. Now, look, you know, one of the conversations I tried to have with Ezra Klein when he came on was, and if you've read the Abundance book, this is what's amazing to me. All the people who said, like, did you really read the book? I did. It was very broad. There was a section about housing, but then half the book, or at least a third of the book, was also about government grants and completely elides like the whole process, other than it was an anti-tax movement that made the government cheap, for lack of a better term, with government grants, because you had
conservative, I don't care if they were Democrats or Republicans, complaining like, why are we spending $1 million on the spotted owls bird poop, you know, studies? That's what happened. It wasn't equivalent to local governments or even the federal government putting restrictions on building in San Francisco or California. I mean, and I wanted to talk about the general sort of broader concept of who's going to get, who gets to speak in these decisions. And according to Ezra, it's gotten too broad, too democratic, because you've allowed outside groups to interfere with government capacity. And those outside groups, incidentally, are not billionaires or wealthy people. They are organized groups like environmentalists or unions or presumably black people who want to have minority set-asides, or presumably women who want to have, women businesses get contracts. Here is Ta-Nehisi Coates and Ezra Klein.
And yeah, this is about, at this point, they're speaking about how Ezra has suggested recently that Democrats should run anti-choice Democrats in states that are harder to win. Now, he had started at like pink states when he first made this argument, and there was such backlash that then he started talking about, what about Arkansas?
Because the initial states he mentions had like voted on abortion post the Roe flipping, and they had supported the abortion rights.
In fact, abortion rights overperform the Democratic Party consistently on ballot referendums and also in the evidence that we have about the midterms in 2022 versus Harris and Trump, where we saw that that overperformance was largely due to the backlash from Roe v. Wade and less about the Democratic Party, which has an approval rating that's in the shitter right now. So I just want to preface this by saying that Ezra's whole conceit here is counterfactual. And he begins speaking to trying to explain how he feels or what his idea is to Ta-Nehisi Coates.
There was like a strategic discipline about finding it.
So I just if you will take this very gentle pushback.
Yeah, please.
I think
you're here for it.
I haven't seen exactly what people are saying, you know, online in terms of this, but I do think like what immediately strikes me is if you take, I know you would just, you know, it's not, you know, the example necessarily that you would hold out, you know, about reproductive rights, but I think the problem with musing about that is abandoning it is a very real possibility for people who don't have the option necessarily to fly to another state or do X, Y, and Z. So I suspect when they hear somebody of your status, even if it's not the example you mean, putting it out in the air, like they feel, and not, it's not just that you're putting it out in the air, it's putting it out in the air and actually, I don't necessarily even mean that one.
No, but
like if you're going to say that, I think you really got to
stand behind
like
it.
You got to put the data behind it. I think that's really, really important.
I will say, and I think this is actually the nub of it, right? Okay. Like I'm glad we're sort of here. Mm. I am saying the thing it sounds like I am saying.
Mm-hmm.
To be very, very clear.
Right.
I think in a place like Nebraska, you should try to run some pro-life Democrats. I wish people.
Can you pause this for a second?
That an
So Dan Osborne will come up later in the conversation, right? And keep going. But like, didn't Missouri, by the way, that could be an example of a state. Didn't Missouri just vote to protect abortion
here's
rights?
Here's the broader problem, is the sequencing is wrong.
Yeah.
The issue isn't we can run some, economic moderate, and all they need to do is be pro-life like the Republican. The issue is we need to have a populist working class candidate. And if they need to, I mean, this is the way, and I'm saying this is how you would genuinely approach this if he was even being anything other than disingenuous about it. We need to have a working class candidate who needs to be forgiven and given latitude on the margins, because this is going to be a marginal seat for Democrats, which we need for this person to vote for, hopefully not Chuck Schumer, but just for the time being, Chuck Schumer to be the Senate Majority Leader. So this person who has a strong working class politics and could create a new coalition may need latitude on certain social issues. Abortion would be a very bad one, just as a strategic or tactical measure, because you're never going to, like, anybody who votes on that issue is never going to vote for the Democrat. Never, ever, ever.
Yeah.
That's not the nature of that particular issue. If you're talking about guns, if you're talking about immigration, if you're talking about, you know, religious values, if you're talking about even like in the context of like of you know, like church stuff or whatever it is, there may be more latitude where that will make that candidate less alienating to people. But abortion is a completely different, it's a completely different thing. There is, we have seen over and over and over again that the anti-abortion forces are almost definitionally binary and extremist. There is no middle ground. There is no sort of like softening of people who vote on that. They do not like hedge. It's not like, you know, it's one thing to say like, well, I think, you know, maybe abortion on demand until, you know, 15 minutes after birth. You shouldn't be saying that. But
people that might be inclined on the margins to vote for a candidate that is a Democrat or, say, like an independent like Dan Osborne in a red state would be hooked by the baseline foundation of a pro-working class anti-billionaire politics first, which Ezra fundamentally takes off the table in his arguments.
Yes, he starts with, let's trade off these things. But all
why?
You're doing is you're just taking a Republican.
But you can see why this is an attractive argument to a class of wealthy liberal, and it's been done before over and over again.
Over and over again.
It was just done with trans rights in the last election. I mean, Kamala Harris basically stopped talking about it. It was done with immigration in the last election. How many times did Kamala Harris say, I'm going to and Biden, we can throw in there too, because he's a part of this. I'm going to prosecute transnational criminal organizations at the border over and over again. You had Democrats all across the country running anti-immigration ads. How many people are we going to throw under the bus before the elite liberals like Ezra Klein start talking about taxing billionaires? Because for the rest of us, we feel the implications of fascism. And that was part of what Coates was trying to get across to him as somebody who is a black man in America. But this is him basically saying, red state women, we are willing to throw you under the bus.
Totally.
Because
I am
trying to push forward a repackaged dog shit perspective that has dominated a Democratic politics my entire lifetime and has lost the Democrats over and over again because there is a elite capture here.
And we should say, there's no doubt in my mind that Ezra would say, oh, yes, I think we should tax billionaires. But all of the other things to inhibit the ability for billionaires to exist, he thinks is a distraction. Good.
Expressive or strategic, instead of saying that an expressive or strategic question in politics was betraying or abandoning mm-hmm. the people we wish to protect, I wish what we said was we lost power in a way that allowed Donald Trump to drive the Supreme Court to a 6-3 Republican majority. And that majority overturned Roe v. Wade.
Right.
It overturned Roe v. Wade and actually abandoned all these people.
Right.
Actually fucked them over. Right?
Right.
It is part of, I think, when I say that like the work of politics has become diminished, it is part of how that happened, that talking about this creates this sort of counter argument, well, even to discuss it is to abandon. In 08, as you and I both know.
Just keep this up. Because what's fascinating, I want people to pay attention to this. No, to keep him up, because I want to keep going here. But people have to understand, he is completely avoiding what's happening. And you can look at the Ta-Nehisi Coates face and saying, get to it. He's talking around it. Everybody accepts the premise that we lost the power. Everybody knows about abortion going away. You need to connect. The reason why Donald Trump is in power is because of Democrats' pro-choice position. And there's nothing to support that at all. Nothing. So Ta-Nehisi Coates is waiting for him to say that. Go. Keep going.
Barack Obama ran as a public opponent of gay marriage.
Right.
He ran opposed to it.
Right.
At a time when not only, I won't speak for you, was I not opposed to it? But most of us did not. Yeah. Most of us did not think he was opposed to it.
Right.
Like at his heart, we did not think he was opposed to it.
Right.
But he was playing politics.
Right.
That playing of politics allowed him to name Supreme Court justices. And that led to the decision that created a constitutional right to same-sex marriage. And I am saying that that kind of playing politics is needed.
I can give you an example from the other side, by the way, too.
Yeah, go for it.
Here we go.
Brother, you know what my position was during the election about Palestine, mm-hmm. about Gaza. Kamala Harris was running to be the first Black woman to be president of the United States. You cannot imagine how animated Black folks were. And some would argue the base of the Democratic Party, Black women. You know, we're going to, you know, see this thing. She was not taking a position that I thought was particularly moral. I had to talk in front of Black audiences about that. You know what I mean? And I had to do the other thing, which was go before Arab American audiences here, Palestinian American audiences here, and say, look, I'm with you. You can be mad at me. You probably will be mad at me. I get it. But for me, politics is the lesser of two evils. We've been fighting this battle for a long time. We have never had the luxury of electing people that represented the best of us. And this is why I'm voting for her. This is a really, really serious thing. And when you hear these Palestinian Americans, and when you hear these Muslim Americans, and when you hear these Arab Americans upset about this, you know, you can't just yell at them. You have to take them seriously. These were hard, very, very difficult conversations. But they were, when I made those conversations, look, man, I had to be buttoned up about it. I just think you take very, very seriously the need to convince people outside of the tent right now, right? About yeah. like we have to convince them to come in. I guess what I want from you is I want you to take as seriously people who are in the tent and who are vulnerable and afraid. And if you have to convince them of something that's extremely, extremely uncomfortable, or tell them that you're taking a position that is extremely uncomfortable, I just think you owe them a little more. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, man, that's fine. I'll take it. But I want to put this on you for a minute.
Okay,
right?
Okay. So that critique, he just completely elides. I'll take it, whatever that means. I don't know what that means. But it is quite clear that making absolutely no political gesture to people who were enraged or upset or uncomfortable about the genocide, even the slightest political gesture, was a massive, perhaps election-fatal mistake by Kamala Harris. I can assure you that her softening on abortion rights would have not gained her one single vote. There is absolutely zero data to suggest that she's going to get one single vote from that. It is quite clear that they knew Democrats were moving away from Israel during that election. Prior to it, actually, there was plenty of data. They explicitly ignored data. They told their canvassers, do not report on what people are saying about Gaza anymore. We're not even calculating that stuff. So if you're going to talk about politics first, put aside every other question, principles, values, safety of individuals, et cetera, et cetera. to not bring that up as a first order problem when you're assessing that election. But also, like, you're completely ignoring how Biden got into office. And in 2018, abortion's just the worst of, aside from the, like, the moral implications, and it's not equivalent to gay marriage because gay marriage was moving forward. Abortion rights are going backwards. It is not equivalent.
Can
it's
you put that
not.
Up, the chart I sent? Because I also think, first of all, Ezra relies a lot on Obama as his model for a president. That would not be my model. He's the best president of my lifetime, but that does not mean that he was a transformational president. And in part, his cowardice on this issue was a problem. Now, Ezra would look at this chart and would say, okay, where did how did public opinion change so dramatically? I would argue that it changed because the president of the United States, first Biden came out as VP and then Obama, came out in favor of it and caused that chart to shoot dramatically up about how marriages should be valid and recognized by law, et cetera. This is Gallup. Because that's Obama using the bully pulpit to advocate for common sense human rights for people in this country. When you look at politics at, from a perspective of political cowardice, then you let the public opinion lead you in a certain direction and work backwards from there. And that was the whole Biden theory in many ways, although, of course, not on the issue of Israel. We can't touch that, even though it would be overwhelmingly popular for us to change course there. This is about weak leadership and leading from behind. And Donald Trump has changed indelibly the structure and nature of our politics by having a message. It's one that's insane. It's one that's rooted in xenophobia, racism, and fascism, all of that. But he repeated it over and over again and used his power and used the bully pulpit to affect public conversation and opinion. And what is the Democrat on his signature issue, immigration? And what is the Democratic response to that, which is what Ezra's advocating for on a variety of other issues? Well, let's see the framing. So you have somebody who has changed the framing forever. And your response is, let's accept that. That's why people hate Democrats, because they can't get behind a message, a unifying one, that is in contrast to the fascistic one of Donald Trump. And it's not that hard to do. It's being portrayed as very difficult and some mathematical equation of which people you can throw under the bus. And how can you manipulate the public by abandoning certain issues? It's not that hard. It's just there's money in between us and the common sense.
His is a total straw man, because first off, I can't, like, I'm trying to think of the example of what he is railing against that the Democrats have, like, cut loose potential candidates in these states that he's talking about because they're anti-abortion. First off, I'm not even sure if that's the case. But B, The gay marriage analogy is just a poor one. It's just a poor analogy, because because Obama's specific notion would have been at that time. I know this. I actually sat in a conversation, you know, when he was a primary candidate, where he's saying, like, you know, we would not go when we're getting civil rights. We would not first, you know, attack anti-miscegenation laws. Okay. You're talking about a trajectory on how you get to a certain place. It is a completely different. He had not given up on marriage equality at all.
Right.
He had not said we shouldn't get there. He was just saying the best right now is not the time. Okay. And he may have been right. It may have not been something that he needed to do in that moment that would help him get elected to take that position, and it wouldn't have necessarily pushed that position forward. But I'm sorry, abortion rights is a fundamentally different issue, because it was an individual right that was taken away after 50 years. It has far broader support at this moment than marriage equality did. It's just not the proper analogy for someone who is being supposedly so specific about a recipe to win politics, period. And he's pretending, like, he keeps going back and forth. It's fascinating because when I tried to talk politics with him on this show, he immediately went down into this very fucking granular policy positions about housing in San Francisco.
Yeah.
And then when he goes broad for politics, he's sort of like, well, let's not talk about any of that.
I was talking a little bit about this with my sister yesterday. I just want to give her a little credit. She was, you know, saying how in Kamala Harris's book, she mentioned that thing about Buttigieg and not, you know, wanting to pick, thinking America was ready for a gay VP. And, you know, we're not fans of Buttigieg or whatever. But it was an insane admission from Harris because it's just another window into how they view their role in public service, which is it's one of pandering. It looks like pandering. It smells like pandering. And she was a victim of pandering and was also thinking about it in the same way in her selection process. And people can smell that at this point. You know, why we talk about a working class politics and why Ezra is approaching it from the exact opposite direction is that it's the most broad-based foundation that you can create to bring in a bunch of other different coalitions into your already existing base. And I would have added to what Coates was saying about how Ezra's argument abandons the people in the base to a degree. I mean, there are many people in the so-called base. The Democrats should expand who the base is because they've narrowed it over the years from what the Obama coalition was, which was a multiracial, broad-based coalition, to wealthy suburbanites. They have so significantly narrowed their coalition that they have not created an environment for them to appeal to those other groups. And how you do that is you create an underlying structure of class-based politics, especially in the era that we're living through of untold income and wealth inequality, where we're at Gilded Age levels and people are suffering. So he is, everything he says feels to me designed to avoid that conversation, and it's essentially a suicide pact for the rest of us if the Democrats choose to follow this.
It's good to see Coates pushing back.
Can we read the comments, please? Can we before we move on? My tweet? No, just scroll down. This is Ezra's own. This is, well, there was a, Ezra's own comment section on the Ezra Klein Show. Was silence not an option? That was what was asked of Ezra by Coates about the Charlie Kirk op-ed. I find that Ezra Klein is doing a lot of dancing around rather than admitting to his approach to that article. Blah, blah, blah. Keep going. Wonderful, as usual, to hear from Coates' clarity and passion. This discussion lays bare the differences between privileged existence versus lived reality of people of color.
Find it terrifying that Ezra Klein says we should not look too deeply at the historical context when viewing present day events.
I really don't think Ezra is aware of how out of touch he is. No one on the left that I know agrees with him on almost anything, and he has such a condescending air about him that is not helping at all.
Yeah, well, are you a venture capitalist?
This is crazy.
This is his own channel.
I'm surprised Klein can't see the fallacy he's committing here. Sure, you don't have to dump all over Kirk immediately after his death. The jump to that to I must lie about him doing politics the right way is wild.
I had a tweet with screenshots, but I didn't even want to show that because it could look like I was being selective. No, that's what it looks like.
Sam, do you remember who Bart Stupak was?
Bart Stupak?
Rep Bart Stupak, Michigan Democrat.
Yes.
He was sort of the pro-life.
Oh, the Stupak Amendment.
The pro-life Democrat that sort of got in the works of Obamacare. He lost eventually, or he decided not to run for office. The guy that they had, that he anointed to take his place, was also another pro-abortion or anti-choice Democrat, lost to a Republican. So it's not like it's even like pro-life.
Well, that's
a primary,
the thing, is that like there's no, he's trying to sort of say, I'm the one who is not being caught up in emotion. Yeah. I am looking at this as cold, hard political facts. But the truth is, no, you're not. It's almost like borderline bizarre. There's just simply no, you're trying to make a some type of data argument, and there's no data
to support
that specifically in terms of abortion. Yeah. Like I say, you know, you could make the argument about immigration, but I would argue, and I would say, as a secondary matter, the reason why you can make that argument about immigration is because the Democratic Party has no immigration stance. And there is the baseline immigration situation is so dismal that, like, to attempt to, as a single senator, fight against it when there's no opportunity for you to fight for anything proactive, and there's no sort of, like, broader narrative, if you will, for lack of a better term, in which for you to sort of rely on, I can understand that. The Second Amendment, we're not going anywhere on the Second Amendment anyway. Like, there are political calculations that make sense, and then there are ones that don't.
Right.
And if you're going to make this statement, it's not enough to say, well, I'm being political, and you're just being, you know, you're thinking with your, you know, your heart. No. We get that. Everybody who's responded to that gets that. It's a political argument. Justify that issue, selling it off, selling people under the bus, because don't imply that it doesn't have an implications in other areas. Of course it does. It is probably the reason why, in many respects, there was not an urgency to put abortion rights in to statutory effect and just simply rely on the Supreme Court was probably in part as a sop to the anti-abortion positions of people. But if anything, and again, Hillary Clinton wanted to do that in 2004. If anything, public opinion is way past that. The equivalent today to what he's talking about would be to go to Nebraska and try and run on against gay marriage, right? Like that's what he's talking about.
Yeah,
and
it's just like this idea that people can't smell that. I mean, when people talk about the smug coastal liberal, my God, like this is your. He speaks about the millions and millions of people in our society that are engaged in our politics as if they are sheep, or as if they can just be given a little treat and then go away like an animal or something like that. No, people can sense authenticity. There's things called political movements and energy, and it's your job to create that as a political party. And there's one comment that was being a little, you know, way too generous I saw to Klein, where it said, I think Coates is coming at it from a historical perspective and Klein is coming at it from a political one. But to your point, Sam, he's coming at it from a anti-political one because his whole argument rests on data that is actually the inverse of what he says. And when you're both completely ignoring history and white supremacy, basically, or the movements of anti-feminism, as we have Pete Hegseth talking about how we need to make the troops more male, you know, because more dominant, the more dominant sex, the better sex, the one that should subjugate the other sex. To have this guy come out there and say, basically, women in red states, you're screwed over, and we should run out candidates that will say that to you and pander to you. And you won't know the difference, right? I mean, come on. This is a really deeply rotten problem within the consultant class of the Democratic Party. And I'm not sure if there's a political pundit out there that represents that more than Ezra Klein right now.
I want to move on. But it is almost as if he is just generating a topic. Because it is just like it is almost as if it is just a branding exercise for him. Now, it's one that I think misfired greatly. But the Kirk thing, because no one who is steeped in politics would say the issue to moderate on at this time is abortion rights. I'm sorry. It's just like taken for granted the Democrat is going to be for abortion rights. It's one thing to say, like, oh, I believe we should limit it to the third trimester or, you know, whatever it is. But to be against abortion rights, and as if this is like, it is, it's just so sort of almost off topic in the conversation about political moderation. Feels like it's almost like done just to stake out a position that it's almost like the reactions he wants certain segments of the population, of the political world, to react against him, to define himself in a way that makes him more palatable to another portion of the political world, if that makes sense. Like, sometimes you are defined by your enemies.
Yeah.
And I think in his mind, if I think he thought the abortion thing would just like, oh, all the pink hair ladies will come out against me, and that is going to project the I have the right enemies, as it were. And that's going to make me more palatable to a different sort of segment that I'm looking to appease.
Yeah. And I'm sorry, but like an issue that could make sense is like gun rights, right? Like gun control.
That's what you're saying.
But he doesn't, why does he not offer that up is my question. And it's because gun control is extremely popular among wealthy liberals. It's like, I mean, and as it should be, we should have massive gun control reform. But if you're actually being targeted in the way that he's talking about, you would, they criticize Bernie Sanders for his kind of more, his position on it coming from a more rural state in the past about this. That is something that's more tactical. What he's saying is just, I mean, it's nonsensical. And I do think he's backtracking.
All right.
But yeah, we're,
we got 10 minutes.
Oh, sorry.
646-257-3920. We'll take two calls. 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920.
First of all, how dare you?
Again, also, you know, like, I don't even want to talk about it, but if you were looking for tactical things to do, coming out against AIPAC, saying I'm not going to take AIPAC money would, like...
Talk easy about
low-hanging fruit.
Ezra hasn't come out with in favor of an arms embargo to Israel, so...
I mean, Ezra talked with Ta-Nehisi Coates about how Netanyahu is different than Hamas.
Calling from a 970 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
Hey, it's Paul. I'm calling from Eagle, Colorado.
Paul from Eagle, Colorado. What is on your mind? Got to be quick, because we want to get in...
What's happening?
Bunch of calls.
Okay, so... So I started a website. It's called townhallcitizen.com. And my mom used to work in politics. And I've been following all that. And I've been following this a long time. Politics is an interest of mine. So what I think that the answer here for our country is that people need to organize, what Jane McElvey talked about. And so what I did is I looked at FDR's Economic Bill of Rights. I sort of modified it just a little bit. But I think that Democrats should run on these 10, I'm calling them principles. I don't know what to call them, but here we go. Tell me if you agree, disagree with any of these. It's quick. Number one, a good paying job, good education, good and affordable housing. Number two, clean and healthy environment, clean air, food and water. Number three, Medicare for all. Number four, the open web. Number five, free speech. Number six, publicly funded elections. Number seven, freedom from unfair competition and monopolies. Number eight, economic protection during sickness, accident, old age, or unemployment. Number nine, Department of Peace. Number 10, fighting climate violence and pandemics. Folks, I think it's the only way. Unless the historical reference for this is the Tea Party. The Tea Party rose to take control of the GOP back in, 2007, 2008. With, according to Ralph Nader, no more than 300,000 constituents. If Americans would just come together and form a citizens group, the citizens group would take control of the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party would have to do what we tell them instead of what their donors tell them.
I mean, I like your principles, those 10 principles. I agree with you that
there has to be a takeover of the Democratic Party. I would say that your assessment of the Tea Party misses a very, very important component, specifically David and Charles Koch. The Tea Party actually started was Ross Perot's campaign, and they referred to themselves as the Tea Partiers. And when Perot,
teabaggers.
No, that's what I called them. And when Ross Perot dropped out, the AFP, Americans for Prosperity, and other Koch organizations poured a ton of money into it, and it took over the Republican Party. It was already en route. Frankly, a lot of those things, it was just a rebranding of some combination of the moral majority and their anti-tax fervor and Grover Norquist's Club for Growth. And
don't tread on me.
Well, a little bit of the libertarianism. Like I say, it was born out of Ron Paul. But the general notion that, yes, we need to take over the Democratic Party, I agree with. But folks can check out.
But we the people need to do this, Tim.
Agreed with you. And I think things like Justice Democrats and other organizations like that, at least on an electoral front, are DSA. Trying to do that. DSA is
but
a good
example. But that's top-down. That's what Jane McElvey called top-down. And that's
No.
Audience.
Justice Democrats. I don't know what you mean by top down. You're saying no leadership?
DSA is definitionally not top down at all.
No, what I mean by that is Jane McElvey wrote, and she's my role model. Jane McElvey wrote that we the citizens have become used to become an audience in our liberation instead of participants.
I agree. People should get organized. I agree. That's what
you have to participate in an organization.
But yes, and there needs to be an organization. I mean that's the
participate in an organization that's continuously let us down, that continuously loses elections.
DSA?
You haven't listened to Jane McElvey. She wants you to start a union and that sort of thing. Like, this is not just...
That's not true, sir. The role model for Jane McElvey used, yes, the book in Organizing for Power references unions, but the concepts apply to getting people together and winning something.
Yes, that's the part that you haven't done. You have principles. You need the people.
Well, I'm just saying that this is what needs to happen.
But caller, we're not disagreeing.
I've interviewed Jane McElvey half a dozen times.
That's why we're saying there's a way to work as a collective with something like DSA and organize and phone bank in your community. That's actually the definition of not top down. It's building a foundation within your community. Do you see what I'm saying?
Well, I do, and I hear you. But these organizations, they all want us to believe that unless, because they went to Harvard or because
I know what you're saying, but you don't seem to be listening. And I don't know what I honestly don't know what you're talking about. You want to do this without an organization. You want people to organize into something. If you want to create a new organization, I encourage it. Townhallcitizen.com. Appreciate the call.
I met a lot of DSA folks. They haven't said, played the I went to Harvard card.
You know, like things like Indivisible are, you know, you can get involved in that. I mean, it's a more organized, you know, electoral focus, but they're also, you know, working on things like legislatively, like they're, you know, they're pressuring Schumer not to cave. There, you know, two things have to happen simultaneously. Organize a union. I don't understand, like, why you would be anti-union. Like, I don't. You need to organize towards shared, like a shared goals. But those goals are not just broad principles. Like, you need to, you need to provide both aspirations, but also you need to have like some ongoing principle that, or I should say, material sort of like
gains as it goes. And the part of that can be just the sense of organization, but to keep this thing alive. So I don't know. Calling from a 631 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from? And really, let's keep it short.
Is this me?
Yeah. 631. Go ahead.
Hey, this is Kelly Marcucci from Long Island. I'm a journalist.
Okay, Kelly. What's on your mind?
You know, I think there's actually, there's so much I want to bring up, but to even reference that last caller, I can sense the frustration that is going on up from the left. And I guess what I want to say is, like, 20 years from now, we're going to look back at this time and look at the majority report. And you guys really held it together for our community on the left. And the reason why I guess I brought up that as a journalist is, you know, I am a true leftist. I've been arrested on Long Island protesting for women's right to vote. Oh, no, not right to vote, but right over their own bodies. And actually, I even worked with Nomi Key when she was running for state senator. But there's a frustration of lack of leadership. And I think that's what's kind of being pushed onto you guys, because you guys have been really the cornerstone of this leftist movement for a long time. But we're missing a dynamic. And I think the other dynamic is a Michael Brooks, rest in peace, dynamic, that he brought a levity, a fun, a passion to the left, and also he helped break down the spiritual side of the left. I mean, I actually remember you guys had a caller a couple months ago giving you guys a tarot reading, and I'm deeply into esoterics and spirituality. And that's the beauty of it, is like people on the left, everybody's politically active, but some people like you guys are way more advanced, but we're in the same room. Same thing with spirituality. These people, that gentleman who gave you a reading is just a nice person, but they're not educated on it. So yeah. I guess long story short is there's a deeper level. There's a mathematical, metaphysical level that is missing from the left, that we don't have that long-term planning that's going on. Because I actually think that Michael Brooks, who was so powerful, he was equivalent. He was equivalent to a Charlie Kirk. He was going to colleges. He was promoting the he was revealing the anti-Zionism, which I think the left is missing. Anti-Zionism is a Trojan horse for Satanism. Whether you believe in God or the devil, there is a strong movement, and that's what it really is. That's why you have the Bidens, the Catholics on the left, or you have a Christian like Ted Cruz who can pull a quote out of his ass. But long story short is the movement really is.
I'm not sure I fully follow where you're saying, but I think on some level that may prove your point. I mean, listen, we all have our limitations. I think it's a bit of an exaggeration to say that we're a cornerstone of the left.
Oh, no, I think you guys can't really see. I actually think that also there's so much more to it, like the Joe Rogan, actually, I think, is the Trojan horse. Doing my research, he's had over about 2,500 episodes, and at one out of every eight episodes, he platforms somebody adjacent to Epstein. And he's been playing this, a close Christian, like I'm thinking about it. But no, he's really platformed to people, and the same people, even Bill Burr, going to Saudi Arabia. What? How dare you, bro?
Well, listen, wait, okay, we're getting far afield here, and I wanted to keep this short. I apologize, but I want to say, here's what I would say. I wish we had 20 million people watching us like Joe Rogan, but that would have involved us doing 7 out of 8 shows. Would have
no,
had
I
to.
I think you guys are incredible.
I appreciate that.
Yeah,
but I think. There is a spiritual component to this. I personally, and that's what, one of the things I miss about Michael, but I'm not necessarily that person, and I wish I could be, but I ain't. So I would
I would love to make myself available for that for you guys. I'll maybe send
I just don't know that we are the place for it now. Because I think, Michael.
Of course.
But I would say by all means, I would encourage you, build a platform, and if it's worked for people, I think that's good. But I got to go. It's been 4 minutes.
I know you got to go. I just want to say one last thing.
Okay, one last thing.
I want to be tentative about this, but I'm concerned about how Michael Brooks left us. So,
okay.
Bye.
I got to go.
Jesus fucking Christ.
All right. Well,
that's
look.
That's a little bit too much.
I means well. I will say that I think, I'm not a spiritual person either, but
I do feel when I feel most, my most spiritual is when I'm most connected to humanity and humanity around us. And I will say that I think that a shared humanity and a shared understanding that when your neighbor hurts or when a child in Gaza is hurting, you hurt too. You can have empathy, and that can be a spiritual experience in and of itself. And so for anybody that's feeling like a little bit like their tank is empty on that front, that is my advice, or that's usually kind of, you know, what I center myself around. So
I absolutely like cherished that about Michael. But I do think people who watch a lot of these streams do themselves and the world a disservice when they act like that doesn't exist in the world anymore and that it can't be tapped out. Like, I think Zohran, the way he talks about facing racism or indeed like being accused of being a racist, I think he is like a great exemplar of the socialist humanism. And, you know, you just got to find it.
All right. Final call of the day. Calling from a 971 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
Hi, I'm from the war zone of Portland, Oregon.
And what's your name?
Mitch.
Mitch from Portland, Oregon.
Be normal,
okay,
Mitch.
Gotta be quick. Gotta be quick.
Yeah, no worries. I will be quick. One of the things that I'm glad that kind of has become a theme, thank you, Emma, for bringing this up, is I think there is a kind of a weird staggering amount of a lack of leadership in the Democratic Party mm-hmm. right now. In June, our Department of Transportation was effectively defunded because of the Dems' like unwillingness to push their agenda, and their compromise was to compromise on their ideals rather than a like actual package. And so about 700 people got laid off. And so I guess my question is, and like when we're in this kind of vacuum of leadership, like we see like the Marjorie Taylor Greene of the right, and I know Zizek said in like 08 that we needed some like radical left-wing person to kind of scare people to the left in a weird way of like being like, oh, some of these policies aren't that bad because that guy on the left is calling for really radical things. Like, I guess my question is, what is the solution to infusing leadership where there is that vacuum?
All right. Well, Emma will answer call. And
I'm answering. Oh, you got to run.
No.
Oh,
we're just going to let the caller go.
Oh, okay. I don't have an answer. I was hoping you did because that's
well,
a tough
where
question.
Do we get that in, where do we get that leadership?
Yeah.
I mean, I think it comes out of movements.
Yeah.
I mean, that's like, where does Zohran come from?
Exactly.
Right. You know, you need to. You
where did
need
Grandpa
to
come from?
You, listen, there are leaders out there. The just question is, like, how do they rise? And they rise because organizations form. And then people pop out of these small organizations. And then they enter into bigger organizations. And then they enter into bigger communities and so on. So you have to start with a community that shares certain ideals, an organization that shares certain ideals that is formed to do something. Not to, you know, maybe something, you know, national, but to do something locally, and then it just expands. And then as someone rises within that context of that organization, the organization's values are reflected in that person because they came out of that community. And then as the as that person goes and attempts to go to the next community and bring those two communities together and so on, that person rises. That's how it happens. It can be in the context of like, you know, Marjorie Taylor Greene was obviously like in some like email list. She was obviously doing something.
Yeah.
And then she became congressperson.
She came out of the like Facebook QAnon grassroots, like a little community. I mean, that's where they're at. But we've got to be in, you know, making sure people know what we can do for the folks materially and not ramping them into a state of frenzied conspiracism like MTG.
Pittsburgh power broker. Organizations form or are organizations teleported from the third circle of hell? All right. One last quick call and that's it. Calling from a 509 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
Damn, it's Ronald Reagan.
Oh, Ronald Reagan. What's on your mind?
I just also wanted to put my hat in for... MR spiritual guy.
Oh.
We'll put you on the list.
I believe in single-payer healthcare. I think that's what God wants, and God wants me to have, like, a sick ride and a nice house also, by the way.
Okay.
Nice.
So, super-duper quick, little anecdote on why Ezra Klein, I think, is missing something pretty big. I remember in 2018 when it looked like Nancy Pelosi was going to step down and they were sort of floating Hakeem Jeffries. This is like before anyone had any idea who this guy was at all. I was listening to my local talk radio and they're like, Hakeem Jeffries. And they knew automatically he was like a radical Islamic terrorist. It didn't matter. I mean, he could have been like pro-life. All these things, but the right wing is religious in the fact that they're reflexively anti anything with a D. Like, there's no way to reach those people.
That's my point about abortion, because if you are voting based upon an abortion stance, you are too far enmeshed in that right wing world that you would ever vote for a Democrat based upon their abortion stance. That's not happening, and particularly in red states.
He's hung up.
What an attitude.
Very spiritual doing the Irish goodbye.
He just disappeared.
Yeah, 90 million Americans didn't vote in the last election. How about we call from that group?
Many Michiganders didn't?
Yeah.
Get Haley Stevens out there. Turn it around.
I mean, just
turn my stomach around.
Cult dog. Sam's rushing everybody until this Reagan guy called in. Sad. I know it. Rond sad face. I work at security at a failing college, and every year the administration talks about shutting down the security department, just not having any campus security. Every year, my boss has to remind them that there's been a bunch of grants associated with having security department. I'm terrified that Trump might have killed enough grants that next year they'll realize they can just cut us with no consequences.
Campus safety.
MJS617, have you seen this Trump RX website? Apparently, it's partnership with Pfizer, and it's a place where people can get discounted prescriptions. Yeah. Unbelievable. We'll get into that. But it literally is just running a business out of his...
He's just copying Mark Cuban.
Right. It's right.
Cuban did it.
Right.
All right. Two more and then we're out of here. Charlie Tuna. Thanks, Brian, for the first of all, how dare you drop. Made my day.
First of all, how dare you?
That was Matt.
Stolen valor.
Let's see.
Brian's always doing that.
My favorite thing to do.
Mom, Papa, Mapo, Map of Pompousness. I was watching the conversation between Ezra Klein and Ta-Nehisi Coates. At some point, Ezra said, I was talking about Kirk, but in a broad sense, it reflects something I thought was going to be an argument stretching across the show for a year. And it struck me, this guy's just making content. He is just thinking in terms of seasons of his show. He dresses it up like a sophisticated thinker, but he's just an entertainer. Our media is not up to the moment.
Yeah. Super entertaining.
I don't think it's just entertainment. I think it's part of like his perception of himself as an advisor to the Democratic Party and to a certain set within the Democratic Party. And it's a good set to be in because you ain't like... You're getting invited to nice places.
Yeah.
And it's a nice lifestyle.
I would imagine. Reid Hoffman isn't funding, you know, multi-million dollar majority report fests based on our commentary.
Yeah. Who wants to be in a nice place anyway?
It's interesting why, that argument, how it's so tailored to rich people. It's almost like that's kind of where it comes from.
Folks. Matt, Ryan, Emma, great job today. See you tomorrow.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't